From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the highlights from a year's worth of Bubbler Talk segments, including questions about place names.
My question was, what is 7 Mile Road 7 miles from?
Queries about Milwaukee history.
I have vague memories of when I was little that you could feed marshmallows to the polar bears at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Everybody I talk to says I'm insane.
Why we don't have certain things.
I've lived here for 22 years now. I have never seen a tiller truck in the Milwaukee area.
And the stories behind some Milwaukee engineering feats.
Why has City Hall been under some form of construction or reconstruction for what seems like decades?
It's an all-Bubbler Talk edition of Lake Effect after the news. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's Friday, and that's the day we normally hear our latest installment in the series powered by you, Bubbler Talk. But today we have a special treat for you. It's an all-Bubbler Talk edition of the show featuring some of the most engaging segments we've heard over the past 12 months.
We get a lot of questions on Bubbler Talk about place names and street names, and so that's where we're going to start.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Emily Files. When you look at a map of Wisconsin, it's covered in names that remind us of the country's original inhabitants. Milwaukee, Wauwatosa, Waukesha, Kinnickinnick. Those are all words derived from Native American languages. Another is Oconomowoc, about 30 miles west of Milwaukee. This week's Bubbler Talk questioner, Jeff Diddle, moved there about 6 years ago.
There's a couple dozen lakes, and some of them have English names like Pine Lake and Beaver Lake and whatnot, but some of them have really unique Native American names.
Such as Nagawicca, Okachi, and of course, Oconomowoc. Jeff says he's wondered for a while what they mean. So I asked two experts.
Minnesota, Ndonjaba, Ndakinomage, Oma, Minowaking, Nongam. My name's Margaret Noden, and I am originally from Minnesota, but I teach here in the Milwaukee area. I live in Thiensville near Mequon and teach on campus at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Mishin Zimmerman Jr., Megan Indish Nakas, Minowago, Yukinomage on the way they Nishnabe, Yukinomadi, Wagamagong, Migo Ishitamagok, Benaswe Oldenong, Minowago, Indidaoma, me Thiensville, Migasian Kade, Jaganoshimong. My name is Michael Zimmerman and I teach at the Indian Community School in Franklin and I live in Thiensville.
Zimmerman is a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi, and Noden is a descendant of the Lake Superior Chippewa. They both speak Anishinaabe Mo'win, an umbrella term for closely connected Potawatomi, Ojibwe, and Odawa languages. Today, Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribes. Noden says the oldest is the Menominee.
We have Ho-Chunk, Potawatomi, and Menominee as the primary stewards of the space that we're in now, but the Mohicans, the Oneida, other folks moved into the place later.
She says many of the place names in this area can be traced to Ojibwe words. Noden explains those names stuck because the Ojibwe tribes were heavily involved in mapping and trade with settlers beginning in the 1600s. But Noden says other tribes may have different definitions for certain names. Let's get back to the word our Bubbler Talk questioner was curious about, Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc means they are building dams, and it's referring to beavers.
Zimmerman explains the two other lake names Jeff Diddle wondered about.
Okachi means it is small. So it's talking about something being very small out that way. I couldn't really say why it was given that name. The other word, Nagawicca, Nagawi is sand. Nagawicca means a lot of sand.
Diddle was most surprised by the meaning of Okachi.
I live right across the street from Okachi Lake, and it's out of all the couple dozen lakes out here, it's one of the bigger ones. And for me to find out that it means small, I wonder what they're referring to.
And that's the question for many Native American place names. The literal meaning is one thing, the story behind it is another. Here's Margaret Noden.
Yeah, I always think it's interesting because you really can't tell whether it was a story they're trying to tell, an incident that happened there, a person who might have had that name, or that's how they describe the place. It's very hard to know what it might have been for certain.
Noden says this discussion reminds her of a quote from a Potawatomi author named Simon Pokagan. He wrote this more than 100 years ago. Quote, "It is indeed mortifying for me to consider that outside of the proper names of lakes, streams, and places, our language is being almost entirely ignored by the incoming race," end quote. And it wasn't just ignored, but actively repressed and even considered a crime by the white authorities that now governed their land.
Many generations of adults would not want to have their children put in the position of being threatened by speaking this language.
Noden and Zimmerman did not learn Anishinaabe Mo'in growing up. They had to seek it out themselves as adults. Now they both teach Indigenous languages, Noden to college students and Zimmerman to elementary classes. Their students will know Anishinaabe Mo'in beyond the names of streets, cities, and lakes.
All right, so there are three types of people in this world. Those who notice nothing, those who notice but don't care to question, and then there are those who ask why. Most of us are each of those people every day. That's where this guy comes in.
I'm David Wagner. I'm sorry, what are you doing? Do you want me to ask my question?
Yeah, so we are sitting in your truck outside a BP gas station in Caledonia, right off 7 Mile Road exit. Why are we here? You submitted a question to Bubbler Talk, and what was that?
My question was, what is 7 Mile Road 7 miles from?
Right now, we're just off I-94, 20 minutes south of Milwaukee. Now, after seeing David's question, my first thought was, well, that's an easy answer, Lake Michigan. Like with everything these days, a coworker and I decided to consult Google, and Google said, definitely not Lake Michigan. If any of you are snickering right now, just know I'm not ashamed to be wrong, but we still don't have the answer to David's question. The next logical step was to rope David in on this. I asked him to meet us at the 7 Mile Road exit so we could take a ride. If you haven't guessed by now, we drove 7 miles one direction to see where we ended up. Scientific, right?
That's so right. This is lots of undeveloped land right now. And we are on Frontage Road, is that correct?
Yes, we're on the East Frontage Road heading south.
All right. And so right next to us, we're running parallel to the interstate.
Correct.
And wait, where are we starting? What miles are you at on your vehicle?
Oh, that's a very good question. We're at 946.2 when we started.
All right.
Okay, so you'll see here, we're now passing 6.5 Mile Road.
All right.
So we're going somewhere.
But exactly where was that somewhere?
Well, we're still a half mile.
Half mile away. We got to keep going.
Yeah. And it's still fields and traffic.
Yep, pretty much. It's like that movie, Are We There Yet?
0.2 miles later, and we were actually there, just south of Highway 20.
There's a Toyota car dealership.
Toyota dealership. I'm not sure that was here when 7 Mile Road was named.
And that's our 7 miles.
That's our 7 miles. Okay.
And Burger King, yeah.
Well, there's your answer.
There you go.
David was a little disappointed, so I decided to keep digging because we figured that couldn't be the real answer. That journey took me 9 miles east to the county courthouse in Racine to meet with Tom Friedel.
I'm retired. I am the former city administrator for the city of Racine.
You know those people who know everything? Tom is one of those. In fact, for the purposes of this story, let's call him Tom the All-Knowing.
I can answer a lot of questions, yes.
All right.
That's what you do when you're the city administrator. You ask, you answer a lot of questions.
And so basically, the question is, what is 7 Mile Road 7 miles from?
Well, we're standing at the corner of 7th and Wisconsin outside the Racine County Courthouse. So if you look down 7th Street, 7th Street runs, and it's a section line. Okay. When this territory was divided and surveyed, there were 1 mile sections created. Okay. From the Illinois border all the way north. So in Racine County, the closest point to county government is right here at 7th and Wisconsin.
So what does county government have to do with any of this?
Well, county government would be the agency that runs and sets up the lines and the borders and all of the municipal functions. Until someone becomes a city, then they take over that responsibility.
So basically what you're saying, 7 Mile Road is supposed to be 7 miles from the seat of county government.
Well, it's not supposed to be, it just happens to be.
Okay.
So there's a section line that runs here. There's another one a mile away, and a mile away, and a mile away. You count 7 miles, and you will be at 7 Mile Road.
Tom says street names obviously came later.
I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you live, work, or drive through downtown Milwaukee, chances are your route has been interrupted by this sound. Listener Kate Reardon's bike ride was once interrupted by a bridge lifting, and she noticed something that caught her interest and inspired this week's Bubbler Talk.
As the boat was approaching the next bridge, it kind of seemed like the bridge was not going up. So I was wondering, how exactly do the bridges work? Is it something the boat communicates to the bridge? Is there a person in there watching? Is it some kind of sensor?
To find out, I met with James Washington from the Department of Public Works at the Michigan Street Bridge House.
Yes, that would be me. I'm James Washington.
Nice to meet you, James.
Nice to meet you.
The Michigan Street Bridge is one of 21 movable bridges throughout Milwaukee. They cross the Menominee, Kinnickinnick, and Milwaukee rivers. And if you've ever noticed the towers attached to the bridges, there's actually a person in some of them.
That would be Broadway, Water Street, Michigan, and Kinnickinnick. Of those four bridges, most of the other bridges are operated remotely.
Milwaukee has two different types of bridges that lift. A vertical or tabletop bridge moves directly up and down, similar to a lift you would see in a mechanic's garage.
There's a electric motor that's connected to a large hydraulic pump, and they activate the cylinder, which actually lifts the jacking beams. These are beams that support the entire lift span on each side of the river.
The other type of bridge is a bascule, the classic drawbridge style in which two platforms open in the middle to let boats pass. Routine yearly maintenance for all the bridges involves greasing, maintaining oil, and maintaining the hydraulic system. All the bridges need overhauls every 40 to 45 years, which is why the Well Street Bridge is currently closed. But back to Kate Reardon's question. How do they decide when to open the bridges? Clearance under the bridges range from 10 to 24 feet, and that can change from one day to the next.
One of the main limiting factors is the level of the river. And if we have a big snowfall in winter or heavy rainfall, the river levels could be higher.
What doesn't change is that the bridges open whenever a boat needs to pass through.
The way that the regulations are currently written is that the rivers were here first, so the river technically has the right of way.
According to the city, there were 23,000 bridge openings last year alone. With so many openings, the sound of the warning bell can cause some anxiety for drivers and pedestrians alike. Kate Reardon shares one particular memory.
I remember as a child, my family would do the Miller of Bride for the Arts, and we would bike from our car to the starting point, and I was always terrified of the bridges because I thought that they would just start going up while I was on there, and I'd be stuck in the middle and I'd fall into the river.
The DPW's James Washington says Kate and everyone can rest assured that won't happen.
Sometimes you'll have someone that starts to cross the bridge as we're getting ready to turn the bells on. If that happens, we do allow those people to pass. So there's not going to be an incident where you'd be walking and all of a sudden the bridge start raising and you go sliding down.
Right.
So now that we know how the bridges work and there's no need to worry about getting stuck on a rising bridge, we just need to have a little patience so that we all can get where we need to go, whether by land or by water.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. What's got you scratching your head about the Milwaukee area? Submit your question at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Three Bubbler Talk segments on places and things many of us see every day, produced by Emily Files, Latoya Dennis, and Audrey Nowakowski. We'll have more of our Best of Bubbler Talk edition of Lake Effect in a moment here on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We're listening to some of our favorite installments of Bubbler Talk from the past year on today's show. Our Bubbler Talk segments are generated by questions from you through the module at WUWM.com.
A lot of people have questions about the way Milwaukee used to be, the people, places, and things they remember from years past.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
Yes! I'm going to tell you something about what we just saw. Steal slam. Giannis out of the Kupo.
Nearly everybody in Milwaukee knows the Milwaukee Bucks, and many are paying attention in this strong season. We've got Giannis, Jabari, and a new arena in the works. But what was basketball like in Milwaukee before the Bucks? Listener Gary wondered.
Who played on Milwaukee's first professional basketball team and what happened to it?
We got the answer from curator Ben Barbera of the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He told us that the team was the Milwaukee Hawks. They were Milwaukee's first professional sports team. They first played here in the 1951-52 season. As Barbera says,
they played in the NBA in Milwaukee for four seasons. And then in 1953, the Braves came to town, and now there was a team here that was diverting people's attention.
Barbera says the owner was looking for bigger opportunities, so the Hawks moved to St. Louis and eventually Atlanta, where you know of them today. There are still a few people around who have memories of seeing the Milwaukee Hawks play. One of them is Joel Bean, a basketball fan who still lives in Milwaukee. He went to a game at the Milwaukee Auditorium on 6th and Kilbourne. It's now the Miller High Life Theater. It was Bean's first ever basketball game at age 12.
The memory of the place was dingy and smoky. And don't know if it was because of the hot dogs they were preparing or not, but, you know, it wouldn't have shocked me that people could have been puffing during a game to add to that kind of ambiance.
Barbera says Bean's memories are spot on about the arenas in that era.
They were usually smoke-filled because people could smoke while the games were going on. And it was just, you know, it was a grittier, in some ways tougher game.
Barbera says the crowds were smaller, the arenas were smaller, and there were other ways that watching a game was different.
We didn't have the phenomenal athletes that we see today. The players today are huge and fast and can do amazing things with their bodies. The players in the 50s tended to be big, but not as agile, as quick. The rules were different, too. There wasn't the 24-second shot clock. There wasn't the 8-second clock to get the ball to midcourt. And the style of play was different. Slam dunks were not common. In fact, they were often considered rude, for lack of a better term. And even jump shots weren't common. Jump shotters were considered to be sort of avant-garde and weird. It was a set shot. It was a lot of passing. And so scores tended to be lower. Not always, but scores, you know, were often in the 60s or 70s, which you would never see in the NBA today.
One Milwaukee Hawks player was a real standout. 11-time NBA All-Star Bob Pettit. The Hawks' last season in Milwaukee was his rookie season in the NBA. He won Rookie of the Year. He spoke about basketball on student-run Tiger TV at his alma mater, Louisiana State University.
I like the way the game was played. I think that was a great dedication to defense, to playing together, to passing the ball, moving it around.
Pettit ended up leading the St. Louis Hawks to an NBA championship and was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. Some of the other notable Milwaukee Hawks included Mel Hutchins, Don Adden, and Bill Calhoun. And it's important to note that the makeup of the team, and the NBA as a whole, was different than today, mostly white. But Milwaukee had a few black players.
And in fact, in 1954, they traded for Chuck Cooper, who was the first black player drafted into the NBA.
As far as racism on the Hawks, Barbera says,
my impression is that it was a relatively welcoming place, but I don't know for sure.
But he says that the NBA as a whole was tough for black players in that era. Looking back on that period, the Hawks may have given Milwaukee a start in professional basketball, but there was not the excitement of this year's Bucks. As Barbera explains,
the year with Pettit was their best year, and they still lost 20 more games than they won. During their time in Milwaukee, they won less than a third of their games, and they finished last in their division every year, which meant they were the only team in their division that didn't make the playoffs. So it just wasn't a particularly inspiring team.
Despite that, Barbero says that the Hawks do have an important place in Milwaukee basketball history. He says that the former owner lobbied for the Bucks when the NBA was considering Milwaukee for the franchise.
He said that in the 1950s, the city wasn't ready for an NBA team, but in 1967, it was. And so he was a strong voice between the Bucks even being here.
And a slam dunk by Giannis off a pass by Jason Terry.
Something to think about when it's time to fear the deer. For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
Bango for Bledsoe. And the Bucks have tied the game at 39. Remember, they were down 11.
I'm Mitch Tyke. When was the last time you went to the Milwaukee County Zoo? Did you get a chance to see the polar bear? Well, listener Jessica Oles was wondering about visits she had back in the early 80s and her interaction with the polar bears then.
I have vague memories of when I was little that you could feed marshmallows to the polar bears at the Milwaukee County Zoo. Everybody I talk to says I'm insane. There's no way the zoo would allow you to do that. And even, you know, in my mind, I think you're right. There's no way the zoo officials would allow people to just feed their animals marshmallows. But at the same time, it's such an absurd thing for me to come up with on my own that I'm convinced it had to have happened.
It does sound crazy, but it was a rare, beautiful spring morning the other day, so it seemed crazy not to go to the zoo's polar bear enclosure to look for the answer. Snow Lily was out, but she was asleep and she could not answer Jessica's question. There were a lot of little kids around as well, but I didn't want to put any ideas in their heads. So I retreated to the zoo administration annex, much quieter, inside the Northwestern Mutual Family Farm. That's where the zoo's library is and where I met...
I'm Mary Kazmierczak. I'm the librarian and information specialist for the Milwaukee County Zoo and the Zoological Society of Milwaukee.
You probably did not know the zoo had a library or a librarian, but that is a story for another Bubbler Talk. Mary knows a lot about the history of the Milwaukee County Zoo. Before she was the librarian, she was a Zoo Pride volunteer. And before she was a volunteer, she was a girl who grew up in Milwaukee and went to the zoo. Mary Kazmierczak, is it possible Jessica fed marshmallows to the polar bears and did not get in trouble?
Oh, yes. Not only is it possible, but I, too, have a childhood memory of throwing marshmallows to the bears. This was something people were allowed to do, not only at the Milwaukee County Zoo, but lots of zoos around the United States. And, in fact, we have skeletal evidence of that, the effect on bears. We have a black bear skull that has fillings in all of its teeth.
So it turns out this falls under the category of funny, quaint things that we used to be okay with. Filed under the same category, another zoo bear story we uncovered in a historical photograph from when the zoo used to be at Washington Park. And for a brief period, all kinds of bears were in a single enclosure.
If you're referencing the picture I think you're referencing, it's the exhibit. It was a mixed species exhibit from the 30s, in which they had grizzly bear cubs, black bear cubs, polar bear cubs, and wolf cubs. And the zoo director at the time thought if he could raise all of these animals together, they would be friends.
And this is where our story takes a dark turn that might make you uncomfortable.
What happened is the polar bear is the top predator in that group, and the polar bears drowned the black bear cubs one at a time in full view of the public. The county board did not appreciate that, and he did lose his job. It was a mistake.
But on a happier note, Jessica Oles was pretty pleased we answered her question.
Oh my gosh, I'm not crazy. This is wonderful. I'm just so thrilled to finally have a definitive answer on this. Hot dog.
So the obvious point we should make is that the zoo does not allow this anymore. Mary Kazmierczak puts it in perspective.
Marshmallows are good for s'mores, not for animals.
For Bubbler Talk, I'm Mitch Tyke.
I'm Annalise Hensel. It's finally summer, the favorite time of year for most beachgoers in this part of the world. But Milwaukee once was home to a unique fellow who's the subject of this week's Bubbler Talk. Our questioner wondered, who was the guy who used to tan year-round at the lakefront? Well, many people who lived in Milwaukee at the time, like Cynthia Hoffman, know exactly who the questioner is talking about, the late Dick Bacon.
During those years, like, everybody knew who Dick Bacon was. Everybody knew who he was.
Hoffman shares this vivid memory.
The first thing I think of is this ultra, ultra crispy tan body. And he would have this sort of tinfoil or metal contraption that he would sit in down by the lake and crisp himself.
In the colder months, no matter how cold, drivers along Lincoln Memorial Drive could see Bacon reclining in his silver reflective enclosure. But he wasn't just known for the wintertime tanning.
I became aware of him in the 60s when I was a child, and my friends and I sort of knew him as Mr. Bradford.
That's Jim Stengel, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He recalls Bacon practically inhabiting Bradford Beach in the summer.
Most of the time that I was aware of him here, he was a middle-aged man, too. He wasn't like a 22-year-old or something, but he had a fantastic physique, you know, which he had won awards for. He had been involved in, you know, Mr. Nude Universe kind of things.
The time at the beach was a way of life, and Stengel says Bacon was quoted as saying, "There's nothing for me but the sun, sand, and sea."
He was a character in so many ways. You know, he was a nudist. He was a brewery worker, which made him very Milwaukee. His whole life was devoted to leisure, and he was very unashamed about that.
Stengel first became a columnist at the newspaper in 2000. He had been so intrigued by Bacon that he reached out to him in the early days of the job.
One of the first things I wanted to do was call Dick Bacon and set up a meeting with him where he and I would get together and hang out in his aluminum foil tanning booth that he would set up on winter days at the lakefront. And he claimed it was 80 degrees inside all that reflective aluminum foil. And he was very nice. And he said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Why don't we wait? When it gets cold again, we'll get together." And then he died.
Stengel points out Bacon died at the age of 67, not of skin cancer, as people might assume, but rather of a heart attack. Stengel covered Bacon's service and says he would have loved the tributes shared, but not the fact that it was held indoors with everyone clothed. Dick Bacon lives on in many people's memories, and he lived on for a time in art commissioned by the former Altera Coffee, now known as Colectivo. Co-owner Lincoln Fowler says Altera thought Bacon would do a good job representing strength in the drawing that ended up on the label of one of the varieties of coffee.
I remember hearing an interview on Terry Gross's NPR, actually, that was talking to a stevedore. He said that the most difficult load in any ship's hold was coffee because it was just difficult to handle. It was heavy. It was obviously dead weight. We connected Dick with loading coffee in kind of the context of exporting or importing coffee, and there you had it. He was there on the label, gripping a bag by two ends and either swinging it onto a pallet or out of a hold.
Fowler says while the artwork didn't depict Bacon at the beach or in a swimsuit, many people recognized him as the model, and Bacon got a kick out of the attention, which he seems to have enjoyed almost as much as the sun, the sand, and the sea.
Three segments about Milwaukee history produced by Annalise Hensel, Mayon Silver, and my colleague sitting across the console.
There is more of our All Bubbler Talk edition after another break right here on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Ballyhaw.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We are taking a day to tap into your curiosity from the past year with a special All Bubbler Talk edition of Lake Effect. Many people wonder why certain Milwaukee area institutions exist, but others wonder why things don't exist.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I don't just want jobs that are created in short term based upon a government subsidy. I want jobs that are long term and sustainable. And the most sustainable jobs, 75 to 80%, are likely to come from small businesses, not from employers getting government subsidies.
I'm Joy Powers, and that was Governor Walker speaking to reporters in 2010 about an issue that has been on the minds of many Wisconsinites, including one who wrote into Bubbler Talk. They were curious about why there isn't a high-speed rail line connecting Milwaukee with other cities in Wisconsin and the region. The answer is complicated, but simply put, there was a plan for a higher-speed rail line, but Governor Walker was against it. Rob Henkin from the Wisconsin Policy Forum first came to the state in the 90s to work for a group that focused on transit. He explains the origins of this higher-speed rail plan, which came out in 2004.
There was a very carefully laid out plan, a Midwest Regional Rail Initiative, that essentially saw Chicago as being the center of sort of a spoke approach, where there would be higher speed rail connections between Chicago and Milwaukee, heading then west to Madison, so connecting Milwaukee and Madison and going then all the way to Minneapolis, higher speed rail between Chicago and St. Louis to Detroit and throughout the Midwest. And once upon a time, you you had 9 Midwestern states that were all on board, no pun intended, to actually try to lobby together for the federal government to allocate federal resources to do this whole Midwest rail initiative.
And they succeeded. At the time, Governor Doyle was able to secure $810 million earmarked by the Obama administration to help create parts of this system, specifically a line connecting Milwaukee and Madison. But there was a problem. Kevin Muse from the Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission explains.
When Governor Scott Walker was a candidate, he made one of his platform planks stopping that project. So when he was elected, actually Governor Doyle stopped the project the day after the election in 2010.
Walker made it clear he thought the project would be a waste of money. There were other transit issues he thought were more pressing, like fixing Wisconsin's, quote, crumbling roads and bridges, as he put it in 2010. The operating bill for the train was projected to be $7.5 million a year, which he felt was too high a burden. For perspective, Wisconsin's DOT budget for 2015 to 2017 allocates more than $3 billion for roads. According to Kevin Muse, there's a common misconception about transit's ability to make money.
No mode of transportation pays for itself, but for some reason we have a perception that the automobile does, whereas transit doesn't, which is inaccurate, but that certainly is the perception.
At one time, mass transit was profitable, but that's no longer the case.
50, 60 years ago, you had private companies running rail systems and able to make money. Some argue that because we have so heavily subsidized highway building and automobile usage, that meant the private sector couldn't make money running rail systems or any type of transit systems.
The money earmarked for a higher speed rail in Wisconsin was given away. Other states in the Midwest accepted the money and used it to update their rails and make them more efficient. It's unclear what a higher speed rail could mean for Milwaukee, but Muse says it really comes down to connectivity.
You're providing the connectivity that helps the economy move and makes it easier for people, in this case, to move around and access jobs more easily, shop more easily, access education more easily, which is good for the economy generally.
The question now, what will it take to get a higher speed rail system in Wisconsin?
This week's question comes from Jay Blanchett, and it's about fire trucks. Well, a special kind of fire truck.
I've lived here for 22 years now. I have never seen a tiller truck in the Milwaukee area.
A tiller is the kind of fire truck that hinges in the middle, and it has two drivers, one in the front and one in the rear.
And that individual sits and steers almost in the opposite direction.
That's Deputy Chief John Litchford. He's in charge of the Milwaukee Fire Department's repair shop, which is located in Walker's Point. Among his many jobs is purchasing and maintaining all of the department's equipment, including vehicles. Litchford invited Bubbler Talk to visit him at the shop to learn more, so WUWM's digital producer Lauren Sigvason and I met Jay and his mom, Dee, at the facility. And that gave us a chance to ask Dee a question.
Has he always been interested in fire trucks?
Dee has very many technical interests, yes, since he was a young boy.
And so you're not surprised by this question at all?
No, not at all.
Once we settled into the deputy chief's office high above the shop floor, Litchford had a pretty straightforward answer to Jay's question. Tiller trucks are very expensive, anywhere from $700,000 to $800,000 apiece, and Milwaukee doesn't really need them.
They're used and designed to go down very narrow streets and make hard turns. The city of Milwaukee is fortunate to have wider streets, and there's only a couple pocket areas that we really see a true benefit. With that ability to have the rear part of the truck be driven or controlled by a second person, you're able to take these really sharp turns and go down narrow cutbacks, and where we don't see a lot of that, and we have fairly large intersections, so our trucks can make those turns being on a straight chassis.
The Milwaukee Fire Department has had tillers in the past, but Litchford says it's been a couple of decades since there was a working one in the inventory.
When I came on the job 21 years ago, there was only one tiller truck in the city, and it was located on the far south side.
And once that one was retired, it just wasn't cost-effective to replace, given the kinds of roads and streets that we have and the department's overall equipment needs.
We have about 105-foot aerial trucks, and that's the length of the aerial itself, so that we can reach the same distance that a tiller truck can reach. And even just with some skilled driving, understanding your neighborhood, we can accomplish everything that a tiller can.
With Jay's initial question answered, Litchford offered us a tour of the repair facility, and we all eagerly accepted. It turns out the Milwaukee Fire Department can build or maintain almost everything it needs.
We have a total of 9 mechanics, but in this facility we run about 26 people, 27 people, and we try to be 100% in-house.
About the only thing they don't make themselves are the vehicles, but they used to make those too, and there's still one in existence.
I have a guy who's ready to give it to us, or give it back to us, I should say, but it was one of our original trucks that we, as a Milwaukee Fire Department, designed and manufactured. I don't know how many departments do that.
As we finished up our tour of a very impressive facility, we circle back to our original question about tiller trucks, and we wanted to know if driving the back end of one was as fun as we had heard it was.
You know, I've heard nothing but how much fun the position was.
For Bubbler Talk, I'm Bonnie North at the Milwaukee Fire Department Repair Shop.
I'm Rachel Morello, and like many of you, I am a total cheesehead. Go, pack, go! Packer pride is arguably one of the strongest fandoms in professional football. As far as college football goes, Wisconsin is synonymous with the Badgers. But they're in Madison. Which brings us to this week's Bubbler Talk question. Why isn't there a big college football team in Milwaukee?
The UWM had a football team for a long time. It actually started in 1899 and ran through the mid-1970s.
That's Ben Barbera, curator at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. He revisited the city's college football scene for his latest exhibit on Milwaukee sports history. Turns out both UWM and Marquette used to have varsity football teams, and winning ones at that.
The UWM played at various different levels, Division II, NAIA. In the 40s and 50s, they were pretty successful, won a lot of conference championships. Marquette also had a very successful football program. They started playing in 1892. And in the 1920s, they were one of the best teams in the country.
Both schools sent players into the pros. Guys like John Big Train Sisk and Laverne Dilweg, who went on to play for the Packers and, sadly, the Bears. But despite their success, both programs only lasted through the late 60s and early 70s. School leaders voted to disband the teams. Why? Barbera attributes it to a combination of university funding issues and low attendance.
Milwaukee wasn't a big college football town in this period, so the teams weren't drawing particularly well, and athletic department budgets weren't what they are today. The most expensive sport by far in any athletic program is football because of the equipment, the number of players, number of coaches. And so for both of these schools, when they were looking at their budgets, they knew that the biggest, easiest savings was going to be to cut the football program.
That allowed UWM to save other sports, like basketball, soccer, baseball, and volleyball. But football hasn't been entirely wiped out on campus. UWM has had a growing club football program since 2003. Here's team president Dean Sopcich, a junior.
Well, I think the general consensus is that, oh, we don't have a team, so then that's kind of the end of it, but people wouldn't know to go and look further for a club team that we have on campus.
Just like an NCAA team, Panther club football travels to play other schools. They compete within a conference, facing off against club teams at schools as wide-ranging as Southern Illinois Edwardsville and Ohio State. Their season ends in playoffs, and if they win, a national championship. But unlike a varsity program, this club squad requires less of a time commitment. 2 practices per week and about 8 games per season. And students run the show, managing budgets, coordinating schedules, fundraising. Some club teams even rely on the players themselves to act as their own coaches. Panther football runs with the help of 6 volunteer coaches, including head coach Sean McKenzie. He played for the club team back when he was a student at UWM.
I think a lot of people associate club sports in general at kind of a lower level, like intramural sports. People just don't really think we're an actual football team. When we are, we put on pads, we hit people, you know, we play pretty high-level football.
Lack of spotlight is an obvious drawback to playing for a club team. Junior Dean Sopcich says at times, it can seem like the UWM community lacks school spirit because there isn't quote-unquote real football here. But he thinks his team can build morale back up.
I don't expect us to get to Madison level, but if we can get people to our games, we can supply that demand that people are asking for.
The team finished with a 3-2 record last year, something they'll work to improve next fall. Hopefully, with more fans in tow.
Bubbler Talk producers Joy Powers, Bonnie North, and Rachel Morello explaining why we don't have high-speed rail, tiller trucks, or major college football. We'll take one last break and return with the best of Bubbler Talk on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is the best of Bubbler Talk on Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Don't forget, you can submit questions for future Bubbler Talk segments at WUWM.com. Lots of people over the past year were curious about some Milwaukee-area man-made structures.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Susan Benz. We kick off Season 6 of Bubbler Talk with a question with a Lake Michigan theme. Where did the rocks that form the Milwaukee breakwater come from, and how did they get there? Larry Sullivan knows a lot about the structures. He's chief engineer with Milwaukee's Port Authority.
It was built by the federal government to create a harbor of refuge for boats to get away from the storm.
The breakwater, you can say break wall if you prefer, is about a half mile out into the lake and is nearly 4 miles in length. The system was built in stages, starting in 1881 at its north end near McKinley Park, and then grew to stretch just shy of South Shore Park in Bayview. Milwaukee's harbor was and remains a Great Lakes shipping hub, and Sullivan adds, additional valuable real estate lies within the breakwater's protective walls.
The surge treatment plant, Summerfest, the art museum, the harbor facilities, there's maybe $1 billion worth of infrastructure that breakwater protects it.
The more than century-old structure has evolved over time. Rocks, smaller ones at the bottom, to sometimes 10-ton monsters at the top, add protection to the stretches of concrete-reinforced wall most buffeted by the waves. The stone is quarried as far away as Wausau in Marathon County and as near as Sussex in Waukesha County. That's where Bob comes in.
My name is Bob Stanek. I'm with the Army Corps of Engineers, and I am the Chief of Operations and Maintenance for the Lake Michigan area.
We meet at the northern edge of the breakwater, just north of McKinley Marina and south of Bradford Beach. This Milwaukee system represents 4 out of 13 miles of breakwater and other structures around Lake Michigan that Stanek says are in constant need of attention.
They're old. In Milwaukee, for instance, it's actually a timber cribbing, so if you can imagine Lincoln logs, you put them together, and then they're filled with a small rock, and then on the outside of that, you have steel sheet piling, and then a concrete cap on it. Concrete doesn't last forever,
right.
And a lot of these structures were built in the 30s, so...
Stanek says there's more than age at play. Waves can have their way with the man-made structures.
There was a rock, a stone, in Sheboygan on the north break wall that was about 8 tons, and a wave picked that up and put it on top of the break wall. So that's a lot of force.
Stanek oversees the mobile maintenance team that tends to the most acutely in need breakwaters.
Usually around April 1st, they leave the harbor up in Kewaunee. That's where they winter over. And then they usually don't get back until sometime in November.
So how big is that crew?
Right now we have 10 people on the crew. We have 2 tugboats, the crane barge, and a couple of scows or barges. And it takes 10 people to run that.
The floating team must be fearless and precise.
The crane operator, he actually picks each rock out of the barge, specifically looking at the hole that he has to fill.
Wow.
The shape of it, and he'll spend time moving it around. The idea is to get at least 3 sides of the stone touching other stone, so it really locks into place, because that wave energy is incredibly powerful.
The next time you'll see the Mobile Army Corps crew in action will be next October. They'll be working very close to this northernmost spot on the Milwaukee breakwater as its perpetual maintenance continues.
I'm innovation reporter Chuck Quernbach answering this question.
Why has City Hall been under some form of construction or reconstruction for what seems like decades?
That's WUWM listener Kim Margraff asking about Milwaukee City Hall, a Flemish Renaissance-inspired 8-story building constructed in 1895. The answer is, first, there was the $76 million renovation of the exterior of the building that started in 2005 and wrapped up in 2008. Except it didn't wrap up for long. In 2011, chunks of stone started falling off, and there was a few more years of repairs. Once that public safety problem was fixed, another huge project began about 3 years ago, mainly in the City Hall basement. Earlier this week, we went for a guided update. Large fans circulate the air as about 15 construction workers move about in a northeast section of the basement. Their mission is to take the weight off the 2,600, 25-foot-long white pine piles that were driven into the soft River Valley ground when City Hall was built. Department of Public Works engineer Craig Liberto says the pine is decaying.
Well, it's just wood in itself, it's fungal rot, things in the soil itself causing deterioration.
The piles, along with oak planks and slabs of limestone, help support the 50,000-ton weight of City Hall. Liberto says the piles have typically been submerged in water.
Keeping them submerged will prolong their length, but again, we have a building that was built in 1895.
Measurements have shown the north end of the building has sunk more than 2 inches and the south half nearly 1 inch. Liberto says what's known as differential settlements were causing problems.
In this case, we were having areas that one column over would have, you know, a little more settlement than the other one. And that created stress in the building and crack in the building, as evidenced by the cracks in the mosaic tile, as cracks in the plaster.
While some communities might have thought of tearing down their city hall and moving to higher and firmer ground, Milwaukee's Center of Government is on the National Register of Historic Places and is a National Historic Landmark. So into the basement went the iron workers, carpenters, and other tradespeople, not to jack up the building, but to try to stop the sinking. A small forklift moves along what's currently a dirt and gravel floor to load in steel beams from an outdoor staging area. Mary Collins is senior project manager for Gilbane Buildings, the general contractor on the City Hall project. She describes the basic fix.
So the existing foundations for the building are not being removed. What we're installing is a new foundation system around the existing. What it's called is a passive load transfer design. So it's actually the first time that this design is being used in North America. They've used this design in other parts of the world, mostly Europe, where there are similar buildings to City Hall.
The new foundation system consists of long steel tubes driven 75 feet deep. Then a cage of metal rods is built around existing iron support beams and concrete is poured over the rods. Later, other rods are installed horizontally to tie the old wooden pile foundation to the new foundation. Over the next decade, as the wood continues to rot, the weight of City Hall will transfer from old to new base. Despite being 3 years into the work, the City Hall project is only about half done. Collins says the confined space of the basement makes going faster too difficult.
That causes us to have to consider the amount of activity that can happen. So we can't overlap certain activities like you normally could on a new construction project, and that does limit the number of tradesmen that we have on site at any given time.
The Department of Public Works adds that keeping City Hall open and restricting very loud work to nighttime also slows things down. While the foundation project moves along, workers are also restoring basement stairways, iron grills, and doors, beginning at the north end, and filling in and replacing so-called hollow walks, old outdoor sidewalks that had nothing underneath them except part of the basement. Also, the tunnel between City Hall and the municipal building is being renovated. Still ahead is the south end of the basement and patching the cracks upstairs. $35 million has been spent so far, with a projected overall cost of $58 million by the time things wrap up in 2022. A sizable burden for city taxpayers, perhaps, but one officials say is needed to protect a 123-year-old symbol of Milwaukee. Chuck Quirnbach, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's not uncommon to see historic homes when traveling across the city of Milwaukee. Sites like the Pabst Mansion, the Schuster Mansion, and the Villa Philomena, to name a few, garner attention from both tourists and even people who live in the city. These mansions are often hidden in plain sight, seemingly out of place among neighborhoods that have changed over the years. The Cavillage Sloss Mansion is no different. I'm Taryn Powell, and for this week's Bubbler Talk, two listeners, Randy Kepsel and Ann Lorenz, wanted to know the history behind the castle on Kilbourne. The huge three-story home sits on top of a slight hill near the corner of 24th and Kilbourne Avenue. The exterior is lined with Greek mythological-themed statues, and there's a railing made from iron, contorted into shapes of roses and seahorses. I visited the mansion to meet Jim Dieter, who has owned it since 2004 and lives there.
I was looking to purchase a home, and I looked in the Avenue West and Concordia neighborhood, and out of the quality of the homes in the neighborhood, this one actually had attracted me more because of the quality of construction and stuff and the history of the home.
The mansion was specially designed for the very first owner, Joseph B. Cavledge. He was the secretary and treasurer of Hoffman & Billings Manufacturing Company in Milwaukee. Cavledge lived there with his family from the 1890s until 1920. Since then, the mansion has had dozens of owners and uses.
Cavledge. It went into single-family home ownership for Percy Day. And then around 1926, the Roger Williams Hospital bought the Cavledge Mansion, and it became a full-fledged hospital.
Dieter says the hospital was the first in the Avenue's West area and also the first hospital of record to take in African-American patients. He showed me some photos from that time.
Stuff in front. And then these are just more pictures of the nurses in front, sitting on the front standing.
Over time, the mansion also served as a hotel and an apartment building. In 1971, it was used as a Holy Family retreat home. But what might be more unusual about the Cavledge Mansion and its history are the details of its construction and those responsible for it. Otto Stack, the same architect who designed the Pabst Theater, was responsible for the mansion's architecture. The iron railings and chandeliers were done by Cyril Kolnick, a famous wrought iron artist in Milwaukee at the time.
See the owl? So they're wise. And that's actually Poseidon up at the top. And those are Phoenix, they're the balcony up on top up there.
A love of Milwaukee history is what sparked our Bubbler Talk questioners Anne Lorenz and her husband Randy Kepsel's interest in the Cavledge Mansion.
It was in such an odd spot, too. You just kind of don't see it every day kind of thing. It's like, oh, we turned here and there it was.
She says she thinks it's important to try and preserve these pieces of Milwaukee history.
I think it's so interesting, just the history of the city and where it's been and where it's going and what it is now.
So if you're ever near 24th and Kilbourne Avenue, take some time to admire one of the oldest mansions in Milwaukee. Tours just might be available in the near future for you to take a peek inside.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com.
Bubbler Talk's Man-Made Structure segments produced by Taryn Powell, Chuck Kornbach, and Susan Bentz. And that wraps up today's All Bubbler Talk edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.